ladies and gentlemen. This is Mona Montgomery with this evening's edition of The Hula Hoax. There were no gas chambers in Germany, and there was no Jew skin lampshade either, much less pure Jew fat soap. What there was the most enormous propaganda campaign perpetrated by communists on the white race that we've ever seen in history, except for today, when we're seeing the same machinery convince us to go into the Third World War, as if the First and Second World War wasn't enough, not to mention the Civil War and the Revolutionary War, all of them fratricidal wars in which the white man was the big loser and the Jew the big winner, and which got us nothing. Did you like yesterday's show with Hal Turner talking to L.J. Lauro? I sure did. I thought he was a fabulous speaker, and I was so glad that we got first-hand eyewitness account of a guy who actually was in one of the command centers during 9/11 and saw with his own eyes a memo that said that this test, this massive war game that was going on for at least 6 hours before 9/11, was the first one he'd ever seen in his career in the military that was classified as top secret. And he thought about that when he went in and he saw this memo that said top secret, and he thought to himself, wonder why this is going to be top secret when the highest classification for any of the other military trainings that I've been involved with has at most been classified as secret. And then we got to watch him go through that day, the 6 hours of watching these computerized screens where all of the pretend airplanes were doing the things they were doing. And he was in the high command station, and everybody was looking on the screen, and they were seeing phony stuff and real stuff and pretend stuff and green stuff and blue stuff. And then all of a sudden, they saw the actual Twin Towers getting hit by the first airplane. And they were just, he said they were just amazed. They just couldn't, he said he was overwhelmed. He lost all ability to rationalize the situation is the word he used. And then they watched and they saw the next foot tower get hit by an airplane. And they were all thinking, why aren't the planes scrambling? This is real. Why isn't Cheney doing something? And then he made the comment that actually it was kind of weird from their point of view that Cheney was even put in command of NORAD, because Cheney was a civilian, not a military man. But he had been appointed to handle NORAD instead of having a military person put in that position a couple of months before the training exercise that resulted in the attack on the World Towers. If you want to call me up and talk to me about this or anything else I have to say, and we will be talking about some controversial subjects, give me a phone call at 201-484-7809, and we can talk it over together on the air. So, after the show, after this man gave this stunning testimony in which he talks about getting these letters, if you're in the military, you always get a letter that tells you your position and the chain of command right up to the commander-in-chief, which is the president. So he got these memos that said that Cheney was put in the position of being in charge of NORAD, and he didn't think it was right to have a non-military person put in charge of NORAD. But the real question that I wanted to ask the audience is, do you think that Cheney knew what was going on? Or do you think, as I do, that Cheney is just a white doofus, a club man? I'll repeat that because I got a little static. A club man who gets, you know, dressed up and down seven times a day. I mean, this is what these executives do. They are not thinkers. They are not intelligent particularly. Yes, they have high IQs. They have to conduct the business that they do, but primarily they change clothes about seven times a day, just like European royalty. That's the real job description of a president or a vice president, and you show up about seven affairs a day. So I personally don't think either Bush or Cheney knew. I think that this was not an inside job. I think it was an outside job. And I agree with Captain Eric May, who had a wonderful interview with Hal Turner, that you can look up on his archives, in which he said it was a British Yiddish operation all the way. And he also told us in that interview between Captain Eric May and Hal Turner that they had the same type of training operations going on during the Spanish attack and the attack in London on 7/11 as opposed to 9/11. And that this is an international group of bad people. We know them as banksters. They're about to pull the plug on our economy. And I think that they play our executives like violins because they're very easy to play with. I've been a member of a club enough to know how the game is played. And the most important is that you look nicely and that you behave nicely and that you dress nicely and that you take orders. That's how you get anywhere in the world of clubs, which is basically what politics is. I actually got kicked out of my club, the Kiwanis Club, because I was questioning 9/11, and actually I told a dirty joke about Negroes. I was talking to a white guy on chat, and I said, you know, you can't expect the black people to understand you unless you put marbles in your mouth. And that was put up on a phony website by the Jews, and it was transmitted to my Kiwanis Club leaders, and they were ready to just hit the ceiling because I had been rude to Negroes. So I was so felt relieved. I was quite hurt, but I really was quite relieved to get away from that communist social order. But I just don't think that Cheney and Bush know what's going on. I think they're taking orders. I think they're terrified, as you or I would be, to be in such a high position. They're not born to the cloth. They aren't educated by their parents how to be a king or a queen. And imagine how you'd feel the first day you went into office. If you were suddenly president, I guarantee you I would be scared to death, and I'd be just hoping the maid would tell me what to put on and to help me get it on right side out or the wrong side out. And a lot is made of the fact that Bush was reading the book upside down when he was talking to the kids, reading out of the book about ghosts. And everybody's saying that the look on his face tells them with psychic understanding that this is a satanic signal to the world that he's aware of this, that he's a Satan worshiper and is aware of the New World Order. I want to set you straight on that. When I was in the Kiwanis, I had opportunity to read to children in the library, just like Bush was doing. And the first thing they teach you is to hold the book upside down because you're not the one that's going to read that book. You're supposed to flip the book. Actually, you're expected to read it upside down to catch a few words, and then you flip the book so that the children can read it, and it's right side up for the children. So Bush was doing exactly the right thing when he was holding the goat book upside down and reading to the children. And then when I saw his expression, putting himself in my place as I was able to do, I knew that he had done exactly the right thing. Because your first thought when you're told that your country has been attacked and you're in a room with little children is to protect the little children. That's your first duty. You may disagree with me, but if you're reading to children, that's where your head is at. You're holding the book upside down so they can read it, and you're thinking and you're focused on the children. Then you are told your country is attacked and you are going to go into shock, exactly as we saw Bush doing. So I frankly do not think Bush knew, and I don't think Cheney knew. The reason I don't think Cheney knew is because he shot his friend in a hunting expedition recently, if you'll remember. And what we saw when we saw his picture was a club-attending upper-class white man. This is a man who tries very hard all day long to do the right thing and dress right and say the right thing. And here he was on a hunting expedition, and he shot his friend. I think that told us that the stress was getting to him, that he was starting to understand the situation, and he may now. Now, this is our real question. At this point, if you'll go with me on the argument and accept that Bush and Cheney did not know at the time, at what point do we have to believe that they do know, or are they still protected? It's very hard to know. And when they do know, what is their duty? And that's a very hard thing to figure out, because if you're the president of the United States and your country has been successfully attacked by Israel and they have gotten control of your military and can nuke your country, what are you going to do? Are you going to fight them with your own military? Or are you going to do exactly what they tell you to do, which is what Bush has done, which is to go to war against their enemies? Now, personally, I think it's too humiliating for me to contemplate that having been attacked by a foreign country, I would put their harness around my military and go to war for their enemies. But that is what has happened. And the enemy, this is the point I'm trying to make, is Israel, and is the power behind the throne or behind the presidency. An impeachment might be interesting. It also might be a total exercise in futility. But what we really need to do is find out who is giving the orders to Cheney and to Bush. So one of the questions I'd like to put out to the audience is, do you think that the fact that Cheney ordered NORAD to stand down proves that he knew that Israel had hit us, or that he himself was in on an inside job? Or do you feel, as I do, that he was simply taking orders from people who were trying to help him know how to handle being in charge of NORAD, which he had no ability to do? Could it be that Cheney was surprised at his profound responsibility as head of the training exercises and was asking for guidance, and that the communists gave him this guidance, that in fact he is a useful idiot? And given that all this has happened, what is the duty now of the president and the vice president, and what is, of course, our duty as the citizens of the only country in the world that has the First Amendment? Where does the responsibility really ultimately lie? And yeah, it's on us, because we are being inveigled into committing hideous war crimes against innocent Arabs, including torture, that will certainly condemn us to hell if we don't at least try our best to put a stop to these murders by torture. We become co-conspirators in these crimes against humanity because we do have freedom of speech. If it weren't for the fact that we were given freedom of speech by our forefathers, we would not be held responsible at this time in history. But we have that right, and for that reason, we are duty-bound to exercise it to the fullest of our ability, which, of course, people like Hal Turner and Terrible Tommy and me and others and you listening and paying for this radio time. And I know you go out, do everything you can, you post flyers, but you have to, and we have to, and we all have to. And again, I want to remind you that one of your duties is to pay your $5 or $10 or $20 every time you pay your bill to Hal Turner, so that we can keep this operation rolling. Now, I wanted to answer Terrible Tommy, who said, what do we think Nixon was doing in China? Well, I think that Nixon was organizing the terms of surrender that we were never told about. I think the reason we're seeing all these chinks coming into our country is because China, Nixon probably had to capitulate to China in order to get out of the Vietnam War and made deals to turn our country over to them. And I think it's really too bad. And I think the people of the United States should at least be allowed to know, but I haven't been able to find those terms of surrender. Have you? I haven't been able to find any settlement agreement that occurred between us and Vietnam when we got out of Vietnam. So I suspect that some deals were made that were not to our advantage in order for us to get out of there, and that the only way we can figure out what those agreements were is to see what's happening to our country, which is that our borders are being erased and our country is essentially being annihilated. So, getting back to the gas chambers that didn't exist, I think we're about to find that this lie will become conscious pretty soon. I think there's a period of gestation for a hideous lie before it emerges to the consciousness of whoever is trying to repress that lie. And we may be nearing that point. It's almost 100 years since 1940. It's actually 60, almost 70 years. In the case of a child, I just happen to know this as a statistic, who's been molested by their parents. They repress it and they develop a guilt complex because they can't face the horror of it. And it has a period of about 30 years when it comes to consciousness, and the child who's now an adult can no longer repress this memory, and it becomes conscious, and they have to go into therapy. It's just 30 years. That's what it takes. So I would say, wouldn't you, that this lie about the gas chambers is severely traumatizing enough and certainly has the added element of a guilt complex. We see how the white race has just accepted this hideous guilt complex over this trauma that was actually inflicted on us, not us inflicting it on anyone else. So, like the traumatized child, we've turned it around in our minds so we can handle it, and we say, we're the big powerful ones. We're the ones that killed all the Jews. We did all the torture. We're the bad guys. And actually, nothing could be further from the truth. We were the innocent victim. The white race was the innocent victim. Even when you study childhood trauma, you'll see sometimes the parents will make one child do cruel things to another child, and that's basically the situation with the American whites being inveigled to attack their own racial kinsmen in Germany and really manipulated and tricked into committing these atrocities in Dresden. And after the Second World War, Eisenhower killed those 1 million German men by putting them in concentration camps without any food or any blankets in the winter. So we, the white race, have accepted this hideous guilt as if we were the race of torturers, when in fact we are the gentle, sweet people. And that brings up a question that I wanted to run by some of you. It's the question of torture. Is it a racial question? I maintain that it is. I maintain that the lower races engage much more in torture than the sophisticated races that have cooperated so brilliantly that they've been able to create big civilizations. I have read somewhat, and I've heard William Pierce talks about the American Indian torturing their victims after war parties just for the thrill of watching the victims twitch after they've almost been tortured to death. It's very, very disgusting and very wrong and very not white. And I have to make this point because I'm finding that in the rage of the realization of what's been done to us, I'm hearing white people say they want to torture the enemy. And I want to beg you to retain your racial dignity and not fall to the level of such a demonized animal like the Jew, the American Indian, the Aztec, the Mayan, the Sub-Saharan Negro. These are not people that we want to emulate. Even no matter how pushed we are, we should probably think about exterminating some of these people, but in a way that isn't harmful and hurtful. We should never become like our enemy, our evolutionary predecessor, and try to say, well, I can't feel good being a white person, so I'll do it like they do. I'll torture my enemy. Maybe that'll make me feel good. It isn't going to. The only thing that's going to make us feel good is to think our way out of this situation, as we have done before, face the realities, and create the most merciful possible solution, which, of course, is massive sterilization campaign. Now, sterilization doesn't hurt anybody. In fact, ask most women, and they'll tell you they would rather not have 10 kids. So it does not hurt someone to sterilize them. It does hurt someone to torture them to death. I hope you have the discriminating powers to see the difference. And it is definitely time to set up the birth control clinics throughout the world that will give women the power to determine whether and when to have children and teach them about birth control and provide birth control to them. And if necessary, abortion. Of course, we don't want our white women to be aborting our white babies, as we've done in the last 30 years. Aborting, I understand the figure is 40 million, white, 70% of which were white children. This was a real extermination campaign against the white race. But on the other hand, we have to restore and rehabilitate the white woman to have enough self-respect so that she can explain to the man that's interested in her that she thinks more of herself than to give in to his sexual desires because she believes she's worthy of being married. And we have to start demanding that our white men let that be the way it is for us. And if they must enjoy their sexual appetites, they must go elsewhere but to their white women, because we are not going to be used that way. And if we find ourselves used that way, we will use you back. If you impregnate us and say, there, Toot, you've got a 30-year obligation, and I'm not going to hang around and pay for it, we'll say, oh, yeah, watch this. There went my 30-year obligation, the same place yours went. And we will simply, we're too smart, just like you guys are too smart, to be used and abused. So you better face that one. We are not going to settle for being made into biological slaves until you men treat us right. And that means stop demanding sex from us and don't expect anything from us until we're married, because that's the cost. And then we have to pass that advice down to the young girls whose minds have been so screwed up that they don't even know that they're worth anything, much less a white man. Now, in today's Inquirer, first page you turn, you see a beautiful white woman kissing one of the ugliest black men I've ever seen, and it talks about what a nice thing that is. So this is what's being done to our white girls. Go next page and you find out that Tony Curtis is not going to be a dad to Jamie Lee Curtis anymore, because he feels that Jamie Lee Curtis, a so-called female star, superstar, is jealous of him, and he can't overcome the jealousy. Well, the truth is, Jamie Lee Curtis is not a female. Do you think that the Jewish medical establishment was going to allow this beautiful couple, what's her name, Lay? It'll come to me. Anyway, Tony Curtis married Janet Lee, remember? And it was like a dream of two white people having children. And this child was born, and the story is, the skivvy is, that it was a boy child. Well, if you know what Jamie Lee Curtis looks like, you know that he is a very tall, gaunt physique with a lot of strong arms, but tall and skinny. The most handsome man that walks the face of the earth is the tall, slender, blue-eyed blonde. And that was what Jamie Lee Curtis was supposed to be by biology, had it not been for the fact that the Jewish doctor did you-know-what to his you-know-what. You ever heard of circumcision? So then they were left with, oh, now what do we do? And so they decided they would let the child live out the life of a female, and that is the beautiful Jamie Lee Curtis that we know today and love so much because she's so assertive. Yeah, well, you'd be a assertive woman, too, if you were a man. So here's poor Tony Curtis saying, I just don't think I can handle my daughter's jealousy. Well, you know what she's jealous of. Now, Mel Gibson, one of our other superstars, we are so happy to see that, having stood up to the Jew, he is now being blessed with seeing his beautiful daughter marry a beautiful blonde man. So that's one for our side. Then we go to the explosive confrontation over Brad Pitt with Angelina screaming at Jennifer Aniston, I think her name is, Aniston, stop calling Brad. Well, Jennifer, if you're listening to me, please keep calling Brad. We want Brad married to a white girl. He is one of ours, and while he obviously isn't too bright, he's very good looking, and he obviously has smart genes somewhere in that body of his. Please rescue Brad from that half-breed Angelina, who is adopting, with Brad's money, little protein-deficient Negro girl baby to match her Negro self. Don't tell me that that girl has not got at least one quarter Negro blood. And I think that Jennifer has a chance because it says in the magazines that Brad Pitt doesn't think that the baby that was born to Angelina, who had previously adopted these two Negro babies, and then she gave Brad her baby, and we haven't seen pictures of the baby, but we do know that Brad left her side at the birthing bed and said, that doesn't look like my kid. So please, Jennifer, please keep calling Brad. Time Magazine is doing an article on my favorite man of the hour, Ahmed Inajad, this wonderful Iranian who's coming out fighting and telling the whole world that there were no gas chambers. So I thought it would be interesting to see how Time Magazine handles Ahmed Inajad, and it doesn't seem like they're able to completely hide from the world, even in this article, that he's as evil as they want us to believe, where they call him a date with a dangerous mind. And then they show a not very attractive but not too bad a picture of him. And he says the U.S. government should not interfere in our affairs. They should live their own lives. Why doesn't Ahmed Inajad tell the poor United States how to get the claw of Israel off of our neck? He's acting as if we had any self-respect, as if we had any capacity to throw off the shackles of our Jewish masters. The Time Magazine says, he makes incendiary statements. He has declared the Holocaust a myth. He has said that Israel should be wiped away. And he has called the Jewish state a stain of disgrace. Well, this isn't really true. It is true he has called the Holocaust a myth. And I think he has said it would be better if Israel didn't exist, but then there's really good reasons for that, because Israel is based on fraud and has violated all of the covenants upon which the State of Israel was based, like they had to agree to allow the resident Palestinians to continue their residency on the Israeli side of the partition plan, which they didn't do. They drove 750 of them out of their homes and into concentration camps and into other parts of the Middle East using terror, rape, and probably torture, I'm sure, since they're very good torture masters. And they've expanded their state from what we gave them to almost twice of what we gave them in several savage wars, including the most recent, which is Lebanon. So I would say that anybody with any understanding of contract law would have to agree that Israel has violated her contract if she had any basis for it in the first place. He actually goes deeper than that and says they had no basis for a contract because it wasn't up to the Arab states to pay the price that the Germans incurred, if they even did. So he says, number one, there were no gas chambers and Germany doesn't owe the Israelis anything, and number two, even if they did, the Arabs shouldn't have to pay for it. So in that sense, he said that Israel should be wiped away. But above all, what Ahmed Inajad is saying is that Israel shouldn't have 600 nukes and us have none. And that certainly is something anybody should be able to understand. And then he says that the Jewish state is a stain of disgrace. Well, that certainly is true, isn't it? So I think it'll be very interesting to see. Here's a question. Why do your supporters chant Death to America? Ahmed Inajad says, when they chanted that slogan, it means they hate aggression, and they hate bullying tactics, and they hate violations of the rights of nations and discrimination. I recommend to President Bush that he can change his behavior, then everything will change. Well, isn't that true? And is that going to happen? Not unless we, the American people, change our behavior, which means we have to stop buying into the lies of the controlled media. We have to stand up whenever we can, whenever we have the courage, and tell our friends and our neighbors that there were no gas chambers, that 19 Arab hijackers did not attack the Twin Towers. And it's really amazing to see the look of surprise on people's faces when you say that. They just are just shocked. No matter the slightest thing I say, because apparently the controlled media on television, which I no longer watch, I freed myself from television 4 months ago, apparently it's pretty strong and they really believe it. I hear my sister saying the craziest things about Arabs and Muslims and how horrible they are. It's just coming from nowhere. So then I say these little things, and I've learned not to beat people over the head with it. And the look of surprise is just incredible, and it kind of goes into, like, shock that, and then it goes, oh, she's one of those crazy 9/11 truth people. And then carry it a little farther and tell them that there were no gas chambers, and like, well, you know, Hitler was not a sadist, and he didn't commit any crimes against the Jews. He simply was standing up to the Jewish Bolsheviks and saying, you can't commit the same racial genocide against the German people that you committed against the Russians. And seeing as how you've declared war on Germany and are trying to pull our economy down, and every time I give a speech, my guys have to take your bombsters away. You know, they, you know, Molotov cocktail, that comes from all the Molotov cocktails. Molotov was the head agent for Russia in the Molotov-Ribbentrop agreement that I talked about last week, in which Stalin agreed with Hitler to split Poland 50-50, and then when Hitler took his 50%, all hell broke loose, and the Allies let Stalin take his 50%, but everybody declared war on Germany. So that's where you get the Molotov name, and Molotov cocktail everybody's heard of, because they were just throwing them all over Germany. And Hitler said, no, you're not going to do to me what you did in to the poor old Tsar and Tsarina. So he put them in camps. And if you look at the pictures that the Jews themselves painted in the camp, you see that they're very much like the camps that we send our children to for summer camp. Very much like that. And you see pictures of them doing push-ups on the ground and hanging their clothes up on the clotheslines. And so you start telling people this, and they go, you must be one of those crazy Nazi deniers I've heard of. So that's what you get, but it's worth it, because by the time they've had their reaction, I've gotten my 2 cents worth, and they've actually heard it from the horse's mouth. So getting back to the question of torture, and I did want to remind everyone, if you're listening and you want to talk to me, Mona, of the Holocaust, give me a call at area code 201-484-7809. Maybe you don't even have what it takes to send a few dollars to hell. You might have enough to give me a phone call. That might be your very first contribution, is to get up on the microphone and see what it feels like to add your voice to the voices of your white brothers and sisters who are forming a chorus of salvation that is actually going to save our race. And that being your first step, you'll see, be very happy to see how the next steps fall into place. I myself am actually tithing almost all of my monthly income to HAL now, and I'm kind of sitting and saying, well, wait a minute, is the roof going to fall down on me? But I've got it cleared in my mind, because I really realize that we are the holy race of God, and actually my business affairs, as always, are just percolating along brilliantly, and more money looks like it's coming my way. I mean, this is what it's like to tithe. You really should learn to tithe. It says in the Bible, if you give 10% of your money to God, actually to the feast is what it talks about, that your basket will be filled to bursting and overflowing, and that certainly has been true for me. You see, we need a feast. A feast is when you and I get together with the rest of the bunch, sit down and share the truth with one another. That is the feast. The communion, I'm not so sure that's the feast. That's what the church tells us is the feast. And we're supposed to give 10% of our money to the feast, and then we're supposed to eat the body and blood of Jesus. I'm very, very suspicious of enjoying the body and blood of Jesus now that I am absolutely convinced that Jesus himself was a victim of cannibalism at the hands of the Jews, who took him off the cross at 3 p.m. on Passover, and then his body mysteriously disappeared. So I would suggest to you that the feast is the truth, as Jesus defines himself, the way, the truth, and the life. And that as long as we are allowed to sit here together, you're doing your tasks, I'm on the telephone, some of you are relaxing after a hard day's night. Maybe there's even a beautiful mother there with her baby, hopefully, listening to me. This is the feast. We are sharing the truth with one another, and we need to pay for the feast. So send your money to HAL, or at least give me a phone call. But maybe you would rather have me read verse by verse and precept by precept from the Bible and teach you that torture is just not right. Now here's an example in 2 Samuel chapter 12 where I maintain the Bible tells us that David was not a very nice man. And that in fact, he put people under saws and harrows of iron through the shredder machines and made them walk through the brick kiln. That's the hot oven where they make bricks. And he made all of these Ammonites walk through the brick kiln because he got mad because God punished him for sending the Hittite, Uriah. See, David fell in love with Bathsheba because she was so beautiful, and she had a husband. And the husband was a good man, and he was a commander in the army. So David was courting Bathsheba while Uriah the Hittite was on the front line. And when Uriah came back, David made him go even farther into the front line because he wanted him killed, and he did get killed on the front line. That's how David committed a sin. And then he was able to marry the beautiful Bathsheba. But God came to David and said, because you've done this, I'm going to kill your son. Well, then God said to Nathan, who was the prophet that was explaining how God felt about his bad behavior, I have sinned against the Lord. And Nathan said unto David, the Lord also has put away your sin. In other words, he's forgiven you because you have confessed. Thou shalt not die. However, it goes on to say, David's son died. And David was very, very unhappy about this. And then, the next paragraph goes like this, and it's still in the same chapter, so I think it's an actual reaction to the first part. It says, and Joab fought against Rabbah of the children of Ammon and took the royal city. And Joab sent messengers to David and said, I have fought against Rabbah and have taken the city of Waters. Now therefore, gather the rest of the people together and encamp against the city and take it, lest I take the city and it be called after my name. See how these Jews were, they were doing that in those days just like what they're doing today. The Jew takes the city, and then he says, here, you can take the credit. I've got it all set up for you. Just walk right in. And David gathered all the people together and went to Rabbah and fought against it and took it. And he took their king's crown from off his head and weight whereof. The weight whereof was a talent of gold with the precious stones, and it was set on David's head. And he brought forth the spoil of the city in great abundance. And the last statement is the one I'm interested in. And he brought forth the people that were therein and put them under saws and under harrows of iron and under axes of iron and made them pass through the brick kiln. And thus did he unto all the cities of the children of Ammon. So David and all the people returned unto Jerusalem. Now that is where the Jews get their 6 million fried idea. You know, 6 million fried in ovens? Because they have this racial memory of having made people walk through brick kilns. That's how they killed the enemy. They got the men on the battlefield and got them under saws and harrows of iron. They put them through shredding machines. And don't you to this day hear from the Jewish media, oh, they're putting people in shredders. Well, that's their racial memory. And it's right here in 2 Samuel 12:31. Put them under saws and under harrows of iron and under axes of iron and made them pass through the brick kiln and thus did unto all the cities of the children of Ammon. And I think that is disgraceful. And I don't want any white people ever to let me hear them say that they want to torture anybody, because that is what bad people do. That is not what the holy race of God does, ever under any circumstances. Naturally, we're going to have to exterminate some of the people in the world. There's too many. And nobody would allow us to do it gently, so we're going to have forced sterilization campaigns, probably. Whereas if we just had voluntary sterilization campaigns starting in the 60s, everything would be under control. We would have the appropriate number of people on the planet, which is 5 billion, instead of the 8 to 9 that we have. But oh no, 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 nobody lets anything be done normally and rationally. Everything has to be done as difficultly as possible. So I'm just saying, even with the problem as bad as it is today, there's no reason to resort to torture. Now, we're going to go to numbers 5. I can find it. Numbers 5. In numbers 5, you will find the description of an abortion. Oh, all the people, all the Christian girls who have abortions come out of the abortion mills and say, oh, you can't have an abortion. God says very plainly in the Bible, you're not allowed to have an abortion. I mean, heaven help you, lest you should kill a little human being while it has the consciousness of a snail or less. That would be murder. No, murder is when you take a human being and kill him, and it hurts a lot. There's blood, and it's a hideous thing, and anyone with half a brain should be able to differentiate between killing something that is 3 or 4 cells and a live human being that is probably supporting a wife and family and hurts when you saw him up. That is the difference. Now, we can get into an argument as to when it becomes immoral and when it doesn't, but surely it is not immoral to prevent the attachment of the embryo on the side, on the wall of the woman's uterus within 24 hours. But listen to the religious people scream, oh no, you can't have an afterbirth abortion, an after-sex abortion pill. That stops the will of God from taking place. Conception begins. Life begins at conception. He has the full powers of the human, of the person under the United States Constitution to the pursuit of life, liberty, and happiness, and therefore we must put him on tubes no matter what condition he's in. And if he costs us $3 million, it doesn't matter. Because who cares about the real family, the man who actually has to go to work to support his children, whether it's too hard on him to hold 3 jobs, whether he might like to have time for his children. Oh, we don't want to hear the quality of life argument. That's Satanism, because it brings out the idea of variable ethics. Right. Okay. Numbers 5 is a description of when the man takes his wife to the rabbi in the temple. And he says, Rabbi, Rabbi, I think my wife has had sex with another man, and she's getting a little plump. And I, a poor Jew, do not want to take on another job to pay for this child who is not mine. Now, what do you think the rabbi says? Oh, quality of life argument, murder, put the witch at the stake. No, the rabbi says, I understand, my son. No man is expected to pay for the upkeep and board and education and possible penalties for punishments that the child commits, if it isn't even his son. Because it was understood that a man had some dignity, that he was allowed to create his life the way he wanted to create it, that he could have the children that were of his seed, that he would naturally love. He was not expected to bring up the children of another man. So they had this little thing where the rabbi would tell, why aren't I going to maybe it's number 22, abortion mandated to stabilize society, number 5. Why didn't you underline it, Mona? I think it's number 22. Oh, I think it's number 522. Right. Okay. So, the priest shall set, this is how it's done, this is how the abortion takes place. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, if any man's wife go aside and commit a trespass against him, and a man lie with her carnally, and it be hid from the eyes of her husband, and be kept close, and she be defiled, that means she gets pregnant, and there will be no witness against her, neither she be taken with the manner, neither she be taken with the manner means she doesn't get menses. So here she is, she's had sex with another guy, and she no longer is having her period. And the spirit of jealousy come upon him, and he'd be jealous of his wife, and she'd be defiled. Or if the spirit of jealousy come upon him, and he'd be jealous of his wife, and she'd not be defiled. In other words, we don't know what caused it, but the husband is not happy. 15. Then shall the man bring his wife unto the priest, and he shall bring her offering for her, and a tenth part of an ephah of barley meal. In other words, a little bit of barley. And he shall pour no oil on it, nor put frankincense thereon, for it is an offering of jealousy. This is the usual offering. This is not your 10% that you add to the feast. This is a little different thing here. An offering of memorial, bringing iniquity to remembering. And the priest shall bring her near and set her before the Lord. And the priest shall take holy water in an earthen vessel, and of the dust that is in the floor of the tabernacle, the priest shall take and put it into the water. So the man has brought some barley, the priest has taken some holy water, and he's putting this mess from the temple into it, whatever is on the temple floor. You know how Jews act. There's shit on there. Sit at least on that floor. So he takes the silk from the temple floor. I'll repeat it because you don't believe me. And the priest shall take holy water in an earthen vessel, and of the dust that is in the floor of the tabernacle, the priest shall take and shall put it into the water. Is it beginning to look like an abortificant to any of the ladies out there? Okay. And the priest shall set the woman before the Lord and uncover the woman's head and put the offering of memorial in her hand, which is the jealousy offering. And the priest shall have in his hand the bitter water that causeth the curse. Any of you girls know what the curse is? This is a bitter water that's going to cause this woman to have a curse. And you better believe she will. Her thigh will rot and her stomach will swell. That comes up later. Okay, so the priest shall have in his hand the bitter water that causeth the curse. And the priest shall charge her by an oath and say unto the woman, if no man hath lain with thee, and if thou hast not gone aside to uncleanness with another instead of thy husband, be thou free from this bitter water that caused the curse. But if thou hast gone aside to another instead of thy husband, and if thou be defiled, and if some man have lain with thee beside thine husband, then the priest shall charge the woman with an oath of cursing, and the priest shall say unto the woman, the Lord make thee a curse and an oath among thy people when the Lord doth make thy thigh to rot and thy belly to swell. And this water that causeth the curse shall go into thy bowels to make thy belly to swell and thy thigh to rot. And the woman shall say, amen, amen, amen. Go by me. Good. Thank you. Let that thigh rot and that belly swell. I don't want the little fucker anyway. And the priest shall write these curses in a book, and he shall blot them out with the bitter water. And he shall cause the woman to drink the bitter water that causeth the curse. And the water that causeth the curse shall enter into her and become bitter. Then the priest shall take the jealousy offering out of the woman's hand, and shall wave the offering before the Lord, and offer it unto the altar. And the priest shall take an handful of the offering, even the memorial thereof, and burn it upon the altar, and afterward shall cause the woman to drink the water. And when he hath made her to drink the water, then it shall come to pass that if she be defiled and have done trespass against her husband, that the water that causeth the curse shall enter her and become bitter, and her belly shall swell and her thigh shall rot, and the woman shall be a curse among her people. In other words, if she had sex with the wrong guy and got pregnant with the wrong guy, that thigh is going to rot, that belly's going to swell, and the curse is going to come, and that's going to be the end of that problem. And if the woman be not defiled, but be clean, and she shall be free, and she shall conceive seed. In other words, if we couldn't get rid of the little problem child, we're going to make like it's daddy's kid. And you're going to go home, and you're going to behave, because we did our very best. 30. Or when the spirit of jealousy cometh upon him, and he be jealous over his wife, and shall set the woman before the Lord, and the priest shall execute her upon her all this law, Then shall the man be guiltless from iniquity, and this woman shall bear her iniquity. So, in other words, here's how we deal with it in ancient Hebrew land. Guy doesn't believe that his wife is having his child, takes her to the priest with an abortificant. If she has an abortion, good, that's the right way to handle an infidelity. If we can't get rid of it, everybody goes home and everybody's happy. The guy has to pretend that it's his kid. And that is Numbers 5. And that is what I'm standing on when I tell you guys, nowhere in the Bible does it say that you cannot have an abortion. In fact, it basically mandates it. Thus ends the lesson. So, the problem of Jews. The problem with Jews is that they aren't a real people. They're a mongrel people. And being mongrels, they don't have sanity because they have confusion of faith. And they have this idea or that idea. Some of them have frontal lobes, some of them don't have frontal lobes. But all of them are terribly upset because half of their soul is a good half. Maybe. I mean, if they have any white blood. And I think they do, some of them, a lot of them. So what you have with the Jew is a man, basically they're a cross between chinks and whites, and those are both very intelligent races. And then they've got enough Jewish blood, I mean enough black blood, to completely, destroy their looks. They're very, very, very unattractive people. And then put on top of that, the fact that they have apparently sometime in their history collectively bred for these really large noses. Because in their insanity, they tried to distinguish themselves in some way, and they just went way overboard. And I don't know if it's the mark of Cain or not, but I can't think of anything more closely resembling the mark of Cain than the Jewish nose, which has resulted in more nose jobs than you would think if we had girls to walk around in them, at least here in Southern California. So that is the problem of the Jew, is that he doesn't know what to make of himself. He's not beautiful, but he's intelligent enough to know what it would mean to be beautiful. He doesn't have the natural, sweet temperament of the white person. He's got these primitive impulses, like the Negro and the Chink. And remember, the Chink race is not a kind race at all. They have a terrible history of torture and capriciousness with their emperors. They're not nice, not at all like the European monarchs who take so much pride in being gentle and polite and merciful and sweet. In fact, we have this fairy tale about the girl who, the queen who's looking for a wife for her prince child, her prince son. He's ready for him to get married. And for some reason, they can't find anyone in the country that's good enough for him. So the queen, I think she sets this thing up with the 20 mattresses, and she says, I will know that I have found a worthy wife for my son if she can feel a pea, if I put just a little pea, you know, like peas in a pod, under the mattress. I think she starts out with one mattress. So she invites a bunch of girls to stay at the castle, and they all sleep on the mattress where the queen has put the pea, and none of them can feel it until this little girl comes in who doesn't have any money, but she's so sweet, pretty, and she has beautiful blonde hair and blue eyes and very, very clear, beautiful white skin with blushing cheeks and such a nice personality that the queen says, I'm going to test this girl and see if she's sensitive enough to be the queen or the princess. And so she puts the child to bed on this mattress with the pea. And the girl gets up and she says, Oh, Your Highness, I couldn't get a wink of sleep last night. The queen says, Did you have a good night's sleep? And she says, I didn't get a wink of sleep because for some reason, the mattress, I couldn't get comfortable. So the queen puts another mattress in and has on top of the first mattress and has the girl sleep on the mattress again. Does stay in the castle with the son and then goes to bed on two mattresses. And again, the queen says, Did you have a good night's sleep? And again, the girl says, I couldn't. I'm sorry to tell you this, I don't mean to be polite, but I have to be honest to you. And the truth is, I couldn't sleep because there was something that was bothering me about the mattress. So this goes on until the queen finally has 20 mattresses on top of one queen, and this beautiful princess still can't get a good night's sleep, and the queen says to herself, this girl is sensitive enough to be the queen, to be the princess, and one day to be queen. So you see, in the white race, we take pride in being sensitive and gentle, and we eschew torture. We hate torture. But what we're seeing is our own white sons and daughters are being taught the art of torture by their superiors in the army. And this is going on throughout the world. The Jew is in so much control. The House of Rothschild has so much money with their $100 trillion that they can do just about anything they want. And they're training militaries all over the world the art of the Jew's favorite sport, which is torture. And this is what we must stand up against. And this is what we must ourselves never fall prey to. It is simply not within the character of the white race to enjoy torture. So if you ever see yourself going in that direction, stop yourself with those good Anglo-Saxon self-controlling impulses that you have in your Puritan blood and say no to that impulse. That is not right, and that is not white. And so, ladies and gentlemen, that brings us to the end of another edition of The Holohost. Remember, there were no gas chambers. There were no juicy lampshades. And above all, they didn't really have that full of the fat of Jew bodies that were steeped in a cauldron with fires underneath, which we have very many personal testimonies signed and declared and sworn to under penalty of perjury by Jews that they swear they saw these things, which rendered the fat of Jews into pure Jewish soap. And they've taken these bars of soap and they've actually held funerals for them. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for listening to another edition of The Holohoax.
Hey, ladies and gentlemen, to this evening's edition of The Holohoax.